Hello and welcome to a new episode of Foodocracy for Her. So today I've got a very, very interesting guest to you, an old friend of mine from the world of food media, which is Nandita Iyer of Saffron Trails and a lot more. So Foodocracy for Her is where I speak to you about entrepreneurs in the food and beverage space and women entrepreneurs. So this is the first time when I'm speaking to someone who sort of belongs to, our breed, clan, whatever community, which is a fellow writer, content creator. So thanks so much for joining in, Nandita, from sunny Bangalore, though you said it's cooler than it is in Mumbai. So pleasure having you on.
Thank you, Kalyan. And it's lovely to be on your talk. And it's good to even chat like this on video. We haven't met in ages. So
I know.
It's fun. And I look forward to having this chat with you.
Yes. So you know, whenever she's in town, and often it's a pretty hectic schedule, but we try to catch up. And then whenever I'm in Bangalore, we've caught up. My visit to your house is still due and to have your cooking, but that'll happen. But yes. At least, in the spirit of Zoom and the pandemic, we're meeting. You'll be very happy to see what I'm drinking. Huh? So during these chats, I normally drink Nimbu Pani or sometimes an espresso. I'm having this, which is not ABC juice, which I had when we met at La Fori a long time back. This is the black carrot kanji. Ah. So, I had it at Delhi first at Sadar Bazaar a couple of years back. This is by home chef Inderpreet Nagpal. She sent it. The carrots are from Amritsar. And a bit later, we'll be, Nandita's order, done one book already. And she's doing another book. And a lot of this sort of fits in with her book, her line of thinking. We're going to talk all about that. So, Nandita, I should actually call you Dr. Nandita here because you're a doctor.
That'd be too formal, but yeah.
So, and then you went into advertising after that.
Yeah. So, I started off, working in an intensive care unit. After my graduation, and I just needed some time to decide what to do in terms of post-graduation. And as luck would have it, there was some political kind of backlash where I was working, and that entire hospital was like broken down, people beaten up, and it was a bad scene, and cars got burnt outside the hospital and we were locked in all night. Okay. And it's almost like the police had to drop us back home in the morning. It was very traumatizing, very scarring, and just hanging on to and those were the days of new mobile phones were very new at that point. So it was hardly very little battery left and couldn't even contact home. And it was very bad. And I just thought I couldn't go back to that scene after that. And this, even now when I read about doctors getting beaten up by politicians and relatives and stuff, it triggers off this panic attack in me.
I can imagine.
Because it was
I'm the son of a doctor, and from my grandmother's side, everyone was doctors, so it's horrific to hear this. And that was the start of a career. It must have been so scary for you.
Very scary. And it just kind of demoralized me from this career path. And I just because there was an opportunity available, I joined health insurance for a while, a couple of years. But then, I've always been of a very creative spirit and, want to create something, which in the field of insurance, it's really a very dry, very mathematical. It is what it is. You can't really create anything out there. And which is when I heard or I read about healthcare advertising in a newspaper, and through some contacts, I ended up in O&M office in Bombay, and I met somebody, and they gave me an assignment to do, and they said, if you can do this assignment, then we'll consider you. It was as I just wanted to be in that field. I walked into that office, I met somebody, got an assignment, worked on it, and then they were happy to, give me the job. So I was in strategy planning. And so I was in between like, you know, we used to deal with a lot of healthcare brands, pharma companies. So I would be like the person who understands the medical and the scientific part of it, and like the go between the creative team and the client. Because unlike regular FMCG products and stuff, there's a lot of scientific matter in, you know, in pharmaceutical products, like say specialized cardiovascular, neurological medications, where, you know, a person who, an artist or a creative person may not necessarily understand the, you know, how this works, what studies to, you know, go into, details to read, etc. So in that case, they found me very useful as the go-between. And after the
I have to interject, you know, I must say, Nandita, that often I interview folks whom I've known for a while or who are friends, but every time I discover something new. So I've already discovered two things new. I mean, the hospital thing, and I knew about Ogilvy by Abad, but not the strategic planning. So, I mean, my second job after market research was strategic planning in FC Bulka, and not pharma though. And that's where I met Kanaz, my wife, who's now with Ogilvy. She's in creative. But yes, and I think that, I mean, I joined in the late 90s, early 2000s. That's when the company started creating their specialized pharma outfits. So Ogilvy, McCann,
that was the time, FCB, that was the time that I'm talking about.
Yeah, they all had their own. And this was Mumbai, Ogilvy, Mumbai.
Yeah.
So you're a Mumbai girl originally.
Yes, out and out.
I don't know.
And in fact, after that stint is when I got married and went off to US for a year. And that's when I actually started cooking. You know, yesterday I had a talk on something called Ortho TV, which is run by one of my classmates who's an orthopedic surgeon. And we were discussing similar things. They wanted to know my journey from medical college to how did I land up here and doing what I do.
Yes.
And that I was telling them about, you know, how things went and how actually in my late 20s is when I even learned how to I went to US, and all apartments there come with this inbuilt oven and stuff. And it took me 2 days to figure out how to even turn on the oven and see what's inside, what's the stuff. And
yeah, that is hardly there in middle class India, ovens inbuilt ovens.
Yeah, yes. We've never had an oven. And plus, their stuff is different. It's all inbuilt and, you know, it works differently. So I took, I saw some, you know, recipes on the show, but it took me 2 days to figure out how to turn the oven on. So I'm such a late starter in food. I pretty much grew up knowing only how to make tea. And I see people who say I've been cooking since I was 8 and 9 and all. I started cooking after I was 28. So until then, I was only making chai. I knew how to make Maggi. That's about it. You know, when I was fed up of my grandmother's idlis, dosas, which I would kill to have today, I would say, please let me make Maggi one day and eat something for the tiffin time. I don't want idlis today. And, you know, so that's all that I knew in cooking. So that's in my late 20s is when my food journey even like took off, you know. My own experiment with cooking started so late.
I think it's a growing up phase. And in fact, my mom, who often sort of connects with you and chats with you about, you know, food. And I think she's entered some things like her Loki recipes when you've done festivals on Loki on the website and stuff. So even she, like you, she probably started cooking in her late 20s after she got married and went to the UK with my, where my dad was based. And I was telling Tara about that. And I mean, probably she also grew up like you with a focus on education and work from the parents without... you know, now that you think back, I'm sure that we've all gone through that phase where we preferred Maggi to idli dosa in your case, or maybe machar jhol bhat in my case. But now that you think back, I'm sure that there must have been a lot of subliminal influences of your growing up days in your own family, in Mumbai, all of that, which is now probably flowering and shaping your food viewpoint or mindset. What do you think about that? Because the sort of food which I liked as a kid and what I do now is very different. So I think that all of that is now coming out.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you feel that too?
I write about this quite liberally in my columns. Where
in the
a
mint.
Few things like
in the mint
I'm even in on my blog or in Lounge, you know, things like asafoetida, which is hing. Yes. I would hate it with a vengeance. And you know, they and my grandmother would not use the powdered hing. She would use the cake hing. So sometimes it put and like pieces of it dissolved in water and put. But sometimes when they are putting that, some piece would also fall into the sambar. And as luck would have it, I would be the one to get it in my mouth, like, because I hate it so much. And I would just freak out. I said, my God, I can't continue eating now. I was not a picky eater, but certain things like this, I could just not tolerate. And I would just find it so bitter and so, it was just overwhelming in flavor, right? As a kid, you don't really like that. And second was gingerly oil, which is the sesame oil that Tamil folk use. And, you know, our idlis and dosas would be liberally doused with that. And I would hate that smell. It's again a very strong smell. And I would say, please give me refined oil. And now I will say, if I don't have gingerly oil, I'm not eating idli. Like, and hing, I have a special hing from Kanpur. And it's so strong. It's like the super strong hing. Like one granule will give you that flavor. And I will only use that hing because I feel like
you wrote about that.
Yeah, I wrote about
that. You wrote about that recently. I mean, I can relate to that. As a kid, I didn't like
mustard oil. So those two things especially, you know, I've turned back and gone the other extreme.
No, I didn't like mustard oil as a kid. Also because we'd come in from the UK. So, I was introduced to my mustard oil when I was 8 or 9 and I couldn't take it. But now I add mustard oil as a topping and I'm having kanji with mustard seeds in it. It's all part of growing up.
Yeah.
And what about Bombay as a city or Mumbai, as you call it today? Because, you know, it's such an eclectic city or the term which Sahar Deshpande used over here, polyglot. Do you think growing up in Mumbai, now that you've seen different cities, you've seen the US, Bangalore, Chennai, all of that, do you think that Mumbai has sort of molded you in a certain way or left an impression in the way you look at food?
No, definitely. I think, you know, my family, although we are Tamil, my maternal, my mother's grandfather, so my great-grandfather moved to Bombay then, Matunga, in I think the 30s, 1930s or 1940s, I'm not so sure right now. But, you know, so we've been there, my family has been there forever. And, you know, I honestly didn't know any other place growing up because that was everything to me, the city. We didn't have too many relatives in, you know, in other places. Of course, like few scattered here and there. Like we had a grand aunt in Kolkata and someone in Mysore and, you know, things like that. But Bombay was literally the be all and end all for me. And I hadn't traveled outside much as a kid. And I would always tell myself, if there's any place I can live, it's only Bombay. I'm never leaving Bombay and I can never live anywhere else. So, but then, you know, I went off for a year to the US and it was a small city called Rochester in the state of New York. And, you know,
College also over there, right? Rochester?
Yeah, the Rochester Institute of Technology is fairly.
Because I had a school friend who went there.
Xerox and Kodak and these other famous companies. Yeah. So we would go to the pub and most of the times we would be the only couple in the whole pub. There was no one else. So, you know, the bartender was more than happy to keep on pouring our drink. Like, even if you order a large, she'll give you like a triple large drink because there's nobody else to serve. And I would say, I mean, while I appreciate that gesture, this is just so lonely. There's nobody to even look at. And the streets are so deserted. And when I land in the airport, there's no one. So I definitely missed the crowds and that buzz. And you're never alone in a city like Bombay, you know. You can never be alone, even if you want to, right? Because it's got that buzz surrounds you all the time. And I really missed that very badly when I was in the US. And in a year, we went back to Bombay for 4 years. So I had that urge to come back to my city. So though my husband is from Chennai, so but then that was the first time he was living in Bombay for such a long time, 4 years.
He's grown up in Chennai.
Yeah. So, you know, it was nice coming back to my home city and 4 years. And then I moved to Hyderabad, which was like a complete shock because the pace, the things, everything is so different. And after a couple of years, I moved to Bangalore, which is, I think, my final destination. I don't know, but at present, I feel it is. So, you know, how the pace changes, like from Bombay, I went to Hyderabad, so that was a good buffer. And then I could get used to the pace of Bangalore. And now I come back to Bombay, I feel I can't handle this buzz and the crowd and the pace.
And the travel. And the travel.
I make it a point to take the local train or, you know, the local transport when I'm there because I want to feel at home. And but then off late, it's just been Uber and stuff. I mean, off late as in the pre-pandemic, I'm talking, of course.
After but you do travel a lot within the city because family, then your shoots, client needs. And often there's a lot of pressure if you come just for a day and people want to catch up.
No, I do want to meet up friends, check out the new places to eat and, you know, can't miss all that. So I end up traveling a lot. So, so that's my relationship with Bombay. And, you know, I go now, it is a bit overwhelming. It feels a bit too much because, you know, after all in Bangalore, I have my own cocoon. It's a slow life and it's a very quiet life. And Bombay does feel like a stark contrast compared to this. But of course, it's home. And I always, like, you just throw me out there in the open and I can roam free. Here, like, even to cross the road, I'll think twice. I don't generally loaf around the streets of Bangalore. But Bombay, I feel comfortable doing that. I've been doing that since I was young. And I just feel comfortable. I don't think that I can do in any city. Just loafing around, you know.
Yes, loaf, of course, reminds me now of Baby Loaf, my first cat.
Of course.
but I was thinking of the times in Mumbai where we've gone out and to different sort of places. Where from, you know, Vinay Health Home in Girgaon for the Maharashtrian Vegetarian food. In Bandra to, you know, the Taj Tea House.
Taj, different things, yes.
The tea house.
I just love the Taj place.
And you always end up in... And you always end up in blue.
Even today.
I thought maybe today was slightly coordinated. We were talking about Mumbai, and the one thing which I've seen about Mumbai, having lived in different cities and countries, is that Mumbai is a city which really fosters creativity and creative juices. And Nandita was telling us earlier about how that's something which eggs are on. And she did take a very, very different turn by starting to write a food blog. And in case you're thinking by food blog, I mean an Instagram account. No, not that. Of course, she is very popular on Instagram, but she has a proper food blog and a website or something. In fact, her blog is even older than mine. Which year did you start it, Saffron Films? Forgotten.
Which year did you start, tell me?
I started in 2007.
I think mine was 2006.
Because I think yours is a couple of years or a year or year and a half older than mine. So, what is the story behind that? I'm sure you've been asked that many times, but
I've talked about it quite a bit. But yeah, so I think, like I said, I started cooking very late in my life, and I didn't really have recipes, or I have never learned from my grandmother or my mother in the kitchen because I was never in the kitchen. It was always like, go study, go practice your music, go read a book. And their stuff, cooking was so exacting that, you know, anyway, I would not have matched up to that kind of cooking because that's not my style. And so when I actually started, I figured, like, you know, I was always into art, writing, poetry, music, everything. So I just felt like even cooking, I felt that way. Like, I just put together things as they come. And keep tasting, keep changing roots. Like sometimes I'm doing something else and by the end it turns into something else, right? So, you know, sometimes some dish would turn out really good. And I would never know, like if my husband said, can you make that again? I said, I don't even know how I made it. So it became very essential to note down what I'm actually putting in the dish. So my initial recipes on my blog are all like crazy stuff like... you know, ripe mango with karela curry, then, you know, potato with raw mangoes, like all weird combinations because it was only a diary for myself so that I can repeat my own dishes if it turned out really good. And I was very tech savvy early on, and I've also done a few courses, you know, in coding and website and stuff. Don't ask me what it is. I don't remember anything. But those days I had the knack of getting my stuff done, like on the blog, etc. So I thought it's like, I also used to like, I had thought that if I start a book or a diary kind of thing, I'll lose it here and there, like, you know, and get lost.
Yes.
But if I put it online, it's easy to search for me. And I can share it, like friends want some recipes, just easy to send them a link. So that's was my whole idea about starting a blog. It was just like a digital diary for myself and for anybody who wanted to know.
Yes.
And that's when I came to know that there are like full-fledged, this is a food blogging is already a thing and I'm not doing anything new. And that's when I even came to know that such things exist already. Because earlier
but
I said I'm like
fairly new in, it was still fairly new in India. There were Indians doing it from abroad, expat Indians, but not in India at that point.
So even they were like keeping a record of the traditional recipes and stuff. Because unlike, I think also, you know, when I was in the US, the ISD calls were fairly expensive. It was not like you have WhatsApp, you know, that you could just call your mom or your aunt at any time of the day and speak endlessly. So once you got the recipe, you had to put it down somewhere. So that you're not calling again for the same thing, right? So that was just the economics of making ISD calls. And I thought there was an easier way to just write it down in a safe place where you can find it. So yeah, you're right. So all the expat, like Indians, NRIs, Indians living abroad would write all their traditional recipes. And it still is a great resource for us to refer to.
And I think that there's also maybe a bit of the account planning experience which led to this, because when you're, at least from my personal experience, when you're account planning, then you're neither running the business like client servicing or account management does, nor are you doing the creative like creative and the copywriters. So you want, and you believe that you can do a lot. So finally, you open up a blog and do it, or at least that's what I did. So after I was back in market research by then. When did, and since the talk is more about entrepreneurship, so when did you sort of decide to move this a bit into like a career or a sort of professional format? If your blog started in 2006, how many years did it take for you to think of that?
I think at least 6 to 7 years. There was nothing called monetization or something. I randomly put in Google Ads and I got some $100 check, which I was shocked. I said, who sent me this? But I didn't even expect that. So, you know, 6, 7 years, I think that's when brands started waking up to the potential of this digital media, you know, marketing and doing these kind of brand collaborations and stuff. I think 2010 is when I actually joined Twitter and Instagram and, you know, Facebook much earlier. So that, and those were also just like, Instagram was just to document some daily moments. And Facebook was mainly to share your blog links to a broader audience, which it would reach in those days, unlike today. And Twitter was just like for networking, you know, because I was in a new city, Hyderabad at that time. And I wanted to find out like-minded people nearby to network with, connect with. And so, you know, so the blog and the social media, and then slowly these social media platforms gained momentum and, you know, and the marketing, like the brand started harnessing those platforms more than the blog for their marketing purposes. And slowly that kind of also became like an income potential, you know.
Yes. And I find it interesting when I was listening to you, because now when I see folks coming into blogging, first of all, when they say blog, in most cases, they mean Instagram. And well, fair enough. I mean, if that's how it is, that's how it is.
Yeah.
Because a blog technically is an online place to record your life, which Instagram is. But also a lot of most people who come in now,
just to interrupt you. So in Blogger, we used to write a ton and upload a photo. So now people just upload photo is the main thing and the writing is secondary.
But now people are also, people are writing a lot. So, you know, people like me, when I started using Instagram, I would write a bit more than the others because I'm not much of a photographer. But, you know, but now I see people writing 5-6 paragraphs things, and which I, at my age, at least I can't read on.
Can't read, yeah.
So I don't even try.
Yeah.
But people come in now straight away with a focus that they want to build a career, out of blogging and all that. While someone like you, you've taken 6-7 years before. I mean, it's also a function of the environment.
It was all of us at that time. We were all in the same group.
You have also built a very strong, enduring, sustainable brand, so to speak. I mean, we talk about building brands for others, but you've also built a brand for yourself, and it's been 13, 14 years now, so it's not a small thing. So, and since you've worked in an advertising agency and you know what goes into building a brand, what do you think works, maybe from your personal experience, what helps in creating a brand for a content creator, you know, whether it's blogger, Instagrammer, this thing in the food space, what do you think are the, you know, from your experience and what you've seen others as well, what works?
I think, in my opinion, it's a consistent messaging. You know, I can't say, for example, my focus is healthy vegetarian food. You know, I'm not saying that restrict yourself only to that niche across platforms, because that's just boring. And, you know, even though my niche is that, I in my whole life, it's not like I don't eat ice cream or I don't eat tart. I do other things as well. But I think at least, say, 75% of the time, my focused messaging should be around this topic. Because, you know, I can't say I'm also a pastry chef. I'm also, I'm also a restaurant reviewer. I'm also a healthy vegetarian. I can't be all over the place. Because, you know, then people will not find that one cook to associate you with, you know. So, see, simple thing, like, I learn Hindustani classical music. And when Reels came out on Instagram, I always paired it with a, you know, an evening raga or something that matched that thing, because I listen to so much of that kind of music. And, you know,
you, now you people, sing yourself.
Yeah, you sing yourself
and put it up.
But also people now say, we watch your reels only to know, to find that song more than for the food. You know, so, you know, it's not like one day I'm putting some pop music, some other day I'm putting Bollywood music. So I think some consistency, and I'm not saying I don't, I do use that, but most of the times I try to find a match from my, the music I like, which is this music. So I think it's just an example where a consistent messaging always helps. It also helps in brands to work with you because they know what you stand for. So, you know, like say an Amitabh Bachchan or a Shah Rukh Khan, each one stands for certain things. Like some have this youthful appeal, some are, you know, solid and consistent and been there forever. So like that, I mean, I'm giving Bollywood because it's the most obvious example, which everyone can relate to. But I think as a blogger or a, you know, person in this digital media, content creator, we need to stand for something. And at least most of the times. And the rest of the time, you can just, you know, put out your life as it is, and not like, I'm not saying edit it and filter it so much that you are always creating something like this. No, I also like eat fried food and I eat fast food. I like, you know, sometimes my son is eating some junk. I even eat it with him. I mean, it's not like, it's not, you know, always like I'm eating what is there in my cookbook. No, I mean, I would be lying if I said that. Most of the times we need to stay true to our brand, you know. Like I know when I think of you, I think of your, now I think of your cats, I think of your that little writing corner, I think of your morning breakfasts. So you are doing a, you know, a commendable job of that consistent thing, because, you know, even your finely chopped breakfasts, I mean, to that extent, anybody else having breakfast also is tagging themselves as finely chopped breakfast, and your, you know, Nespresso coffee and the egg, fried egg, you know, like two for you and one for Kainaz or whatever that you guys split it up.
I mean, who's in the writing corner? Because we are both doing Zoom, so I'm in one room, she's in the other.
It's so consistent that, you know, that's how it should be. Like if you think of Nandita or Saffron Trail, there should be 3-4 things that come to your mind, and it should not be that she's everywhere and she's everything. I don't want to be known for everything. So I think when it comes to brand building, I would put that as the top thing to do, as consistent messaging, stick Be honest, I'm not saying adopt a message which is nothing connected to you. It has to be obviously related to your life. It has, you should be able to relate to that. It should be something that you actually do on a day-to-day basis. But just stick to that, you know. People should identify that with you. Like I see any white cat, I remember you now. It's become that.
Yes, yes. And of course, now you have a new addition, a girl dog, who I think wrestles you and your son down. She's the dogs go pretty far. No, and I must say, Nandita, having known you for so many years, first through social media and then personally as well, that I think when you also said honest, I would say that being true to yourself. So, I mean, the two things we just said, one is consistency, and two is you are who you are. So therefore, I mean, Nandita Iyer is not just about, say, healthy, vegetarian food, or she's not just about salads or just about Tamil traditional. So as a person, like all of us, you know, of, you know, 80s kids, 90s kids, or whatever,
we have different facets.
And that comes through. And I remember when my, when Kanaz, my wife, got, you know, more into Twitter, and you were one of the first people she started following because she knows of you through me. And then she said that what struck her about your Twitter account is that it's not just all about food. So it's a person. So she's not a food person. So, I mean, that way the connection is a lot more. And also, like I said, I mean, these certain things, I mean, healthy, vegetarian, good food, sort of thing. It's something which, and then, and different stages, I guess it evolves in different ways. I mean, there's certain things which interest you. Like, for example, I think I've always been about, I don't know, earthy eating in a sense. So at one point it was, you know, going to street food joints and stuff like that. I think the last year, 2020, has really been about appreciating, you know, home food and things. So it's the same stuff. Now, you took two different tracks as a, you know, content creator, writer, YouTuber. Yeah, I mean, she's done like lovely video series as well. And there are two sorts of experiences which you've had. So one is where you've created content through your own channels, like the blog, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter. And then you've worked with brands who are your clients. And there are certain cases where you've worked with people, like, for example, when you've done columns, when you've written the book with a publisher. You've done YouTube with Food Network and India Food Network and so on. So what do you think are the pros and cons of each route? Because there's some people who like to create and be in charge of everything. There's some who want to be a part of, you know, an ecosystem. You don't have to be either or, and that is what you have shown. Even I try to sort of be both. But anything like which you feel are like, maybe let's take working with someone else first, like, you know, when you're working with publishers and so on. What do you think are the pros and cons? So your general experience, not specific person, but the pros and cons of trying to get having a byline somewhere, if you get what I mean.
Okay. You mean writing on your blog versus writing?
No, yeah. So right now, like when you're working with someone else. So for example, say the columns which you've done with Mint and, you know, even NDTV and India Food Network and all that, or your book.
Sure. I think the biggest thing when doing stuff for someone is knowing to stick to the deadline. Because when it comes to our blog, because we don't run our blog like factories, and we fairly laid back. I mean, our blog is not like, it would be good if we had like a good schedule for the blog, like every Monday, Wednesday, Friday, I'm going to put out a post. But those days are gone and we're all busy and it's not happening anymore. But no matter what, like if you're writing a column, if you're writing for someone else, if you're writing a book, I think come what may, you have to stick to the deadline. Even if you're like a dead dog, unwell in bed, you have to type out your stuff. You have to edit your stuff from bed, even if you're unwell. Although, like I'm lucky, my editor's like, even today she told me don't, for my column, she said it's your holiday, usually a Wednesday is the time I submit it for next Saturday, but you know, she said take it easy, you can send it later. I get that. I got that and I was very happy because I also had this thing with you today, and you know, Definitely, a lot of editors are considerate, and even in the publishing world, because of the pandemic, people realize that physically we are so occupied initially because of the lockdown, no help, everything, everybody at home, we have to do so much work inside the house. It's not possible to work at the full potential that we were working earlier. So a lot of my even my book editors were very kind, and and also the impact on mental health, where they understand that you're just too wound up to writing is a creative process. You can't just start typing and it just can't come out like that. You need to be in the right frame of mind. So people have been kind, but as far as possible, we have to stick to the deadlines and not give excuses. Which for your own blog, you can always say, okay, even if I had put down in my diary that I want to write a post today, I can push it to 2 days later. And of course, I am the loser in the long run, because then I'm not putting regular posts on my blog. My traffic is going down, etc. But one is a sense of responsibility, definitely, when you're doing something for others. More responsibility, because somebody else depends on you. So I think that is the biggest thing. And also, it's the positive. The other positive thing is you get to work with somebody. You put, two and two brains together. Because in your blog, you are unless you are a team-run blog, if you're a solo blog like you and me, you don't have anybody to brainstorm, think of what topics to write. Whereas when you're writing for someone, you have that second brain to, come up with fresh ideas and stuff. Right in the beginning of the year, I sent, because I have a fortnightly column, I sent 25 ideas already sent for the next year. Let me know the topics at least. So I remember even you telling me once that you keep your topics ready when you were writing.
Yeah, with the Times of India, I have to do that. So at the beginning of every quarter, give all the topics for the week. So
then, you get some feedback. They say, no, this is done a lot. And, so that. But for your blog, you have nobody. You have to ask yourself, is this worth writing about? Is somebody going to read it? What's the, if I'm actually doing a Google analysis, I'll see how many searches are happening per month for this particular topic. And it's all you. There's nobody else. So I think these two are the major differences in working for yourself versus working with another publisher or an editor, etc.
I can completely identify with that, and I think there's a slide going. So what I know for sure, and probably our readers would also, is that you are more regular than I am. So imagine if someone like you, but that's the truth, that when you're working with someone else, the process becomes better. And also over the years, when you're working with different people, I think we also pick up different things again subliminally, like how to look for topics, how to sort of, word our way in a which way it becomes more appealing to readers. But do you feel that to sort of succeed professionally as a content creator, food writer, you also need to create your own identities? Of course, we started as bloggers, but I've seen there are some people who are very keen on bylines, and this is very important, but they almost seem to sort of run down people who are creating their own content. But I just feel that if you have to create your own stamp, your own identity, that has a lot of importance as well. So what are your take on that? Because you've done both. And I think it's fine to do both. Even I try to do both.
So see, as a blogger, it's all about our personal identity, right? We are writing about ourselves, the food we cook in our kitchens. Or even if it's you're eating somewhere, it's your experience.
Yes.
How did you go there? What did you eat? How did you enjoy that? Will you go back? It's all about us. So it's my blog. It's my space. I'm going to write about me. A lot of people have problems with that. And forever cribbing on social media. Why do bloggers write about their dogs? And they took them for a walk and what their grandma did and from where they migrated and stuff. I mean, too bad. That's my space. It's like coming to my house and telling me how not to decorate my house. It's my house.
Yes.
So, if you don't like it, you're not invited. Simple. So I feel that you know, the identity part is very strong. It's my voice. So I think that is one thing which kind of gets subdued when you're writing for someone else, because you have to stick to their style. Like if I write for a certain magazine, they'll first tell me, read the magazine and understand our style, because they don't want every unless it's a personal column, they don't want every article to sound like it came from a different planet. They want some kind of consistency across the magazine, which is fine, which is how it works. So I think when you constantly write only for others, it takes a lot of trouble to put out your own personal voice and you know, your style, what you would say, your quirks. Those have no space when you come, when you write for someone else. And which is why I think for the longest time when I wrote for others, it was always an article. It was never a column. So actually, when I sent in my first submission for Mint Lounge, my first column, it was about potatoes. There was so much gyan in that. My editor sent back the whole thing and said, I want to know what you did. I don't want to know what someone can find out on the internet. That's why it's a column. It's not an article. So, you know, I had to reframe my whole thinking and how I write, how I project. So I said, why would I write about I, me, myself? That's the very point of a column. You have to write I, me, myself. Yes. I ate this. I did that. It's you. People want to know what you did. That's why you have a column. There's a big difference between submitting an article and a column. So I think then I had to really think, okay, how would I write on my blog? It's my personal voice. I would feel free to say what I felt like, and that's what I should do in the column. So there's a huge difference, and which is why you can't write one like the other. That won't, like an article, I can't write that I did this, I like this, I like it. Nobody wants to know. An article is for like knowledge, but column is for fun. You know
what I feel, I mean, I don't know whether fun, joy, satisfaction, fun sometimes might make it sound trivial, but I know what you mean. I mean, fun, the fun of writing, the joy of writing. Yeah. But, you know, when I look at the columns of your, and some of them are writing now as well, in the food space and in India, like the late Bairam Contractor or V. Sanghvi, even today and stuff like that. It almost feels as if they write it as if they're writing a blog. And what I've realized through the columns which are written with folks is that when they want you as a columnist, they want that voice.
Yeah.
They don't want a Wikipedia of potatoes.
No, that's, voice, you know, no column. That's it.
They want the, like Nandita's sort of, what does Nandita like when she cooks potatoes or when she eats potatoes, or what are her failures while cooking potatoes, if ever, and stuff. And do you think that, and again, when it comes to brands and working with brands, and you've done that a lot over the years, and you've been very selective. So even a lot is also not fair to say, but you've chosen really like brands whom you connect with, and you've done work with them. What do you feel, or how do you think that a brand can make the most use out of a content creator? Like by giving them a brief, or by letting Nandita be what she is, or sort of a midway? Leading question, perhaps.
No, definitely giving a brief, because after all, when a brand is paying you to further their reach and to help them with the marketing, they need to tell us what they want, what their goal is. Like, what do they want out of this, right? Do they want more people to know your brand? Do they want people to buy certain things during, you know, like a seasonal sale or whatever it is? So definitely a brief. But also not give us the whole thing in writing saying post this, because then you're just losing out my entire audience, because my audience who have been reading me for the last 15 years, they know my voice. Yes. And they know when somebody else has written the stuff for me.
Yes.
And when I read it myself, I cringe because I feel this doesn't sound like what I would write at all. So as far as possible, I do write.
Would you put your foot down? Would you put your foot down?
Yeah, because I do insist that whether it's a sponsored tweet or an Instagram or a blog, I'm never going to carry PR content. You tell me what needs to be said, I'll say it in my way. And
if nothing else, there are certain words which are, you know, intrinsic to your way of writing.
No, exactly. Like there was once this toothpaste based, campaign, and they gave me the content which said like, "Hey, I'm so excited about this new flavor," and like 10 exclamation marks. I said, "Look, I wasn't this excited when I had my first born. So what do you think? Why do you think I'm going to be so excited about a new toothpaste flavor? That's just not me. So for God's sake, don't make me write all this, because I can't. I can't permit myself to write like this." It was hilarious. Like, of course, they had a hearty laugh when I said I was not like, I would not put so many exclamations for my firstborn. And why would I do this for a toothpaste? I wouldn't even do it for my books. So, so just let us write in our style. I mean, no harm. There are people, who are always excited and they are this very bubbly personality, and it may suit their voice. It does not suit my voice. I like to think I'm a very balanced person. I don't get like hyper excited about anything. So then it just doesn't suit us. So it's not going to help your brand also, because my audience is going to tune out when they see 10 exclamation marks from me.
But I think brands are also changing, right? I mean, I've seen that totally. Like,
largely they let me do my thing.
Yeah. I think brands are also changing, and they're sort of appreciating what one can bring to the table. And then it's more enjoyable. Then you also want to do more stuff for brands like that, like, or put in more effort.
Absolutely. If someone is paying me, I want to make sure that, they're getting their money's worth. If they want to reach a certain audience, that they reach a certain audience. So I would recommend everything. Like, sometimes when people say do these 5 posts in a day, I'll tell them, I don't want that extra money. I'll just do 2, because 5 is an overkill and nobody's going to like read it also. So I would rather recommend something that's good for them than just go with 5 means I'm earning double the money, but it's not like it's going to help the brand so much. So I would just tell them that's not, or space it out, do it next month. Don't like make everything at one time. So little things, because we know our audience so intimately over the years, and we know what works and what is reasonable, what's an overkill, Although I said it's my space, I'll do whatever I want, but I'm not going to do that at the risk of sounding irritating to my audience. After all, they are my readers. They are who I write for,
And talking of readers, and you mentioned book as well. So Nandita's done one book already, and given it's such a bestseller, even now chances are you have it, which is the Everyday Healthy Vegetarian. And then she's coming with a new book. I think pre-orders have started, and then it gets into market in March 21, hopefully.
March 1st.
So that's great way to start. Financial year, so to speak. But tell me a bit about when you are writing the books, both Everyday Healthy Vegetarian as well as the next one, which I'm going to let you talk about rather than me. What is it that you're trying to do through your books? Because you write your blog, your column, Instagram, video, everything has its own role. To me, a book is a bit of a legacy also. So what are you trying to sort of tell or and tell us about the book, the new book.
Okay. So see, the first book is pretty much a cookbook. It's got like 100 plus recipes, but it's also got a lot of, initial pages are full of information on how to, everybody thinks like healthy cooking is something very tough and you need fancy ingredients.
Yeah, the beginning is all of this. Yeah.
Yeah. So the beginning chapters are full of things like how to stock up your kitchen, what appliances to use, how to stock up your
pantry. My God, you live up 100 years, because I opened this page, it says stocking up for healthy cooking.
Yes. So simple things like recipe guidelines and a lot of general tips. And then there are the recipes. So I think, it's one thing to search a blog for recipes, and people who've been following me for my recipes for like over a decade, for them it's nice to have everything in one place. And a lot of the people who bought my book have literally tried every recipe in the book, because it's not like, when we buy certain cookbooks, some recipes have so many like difficult ingredients, and it's not possible to keep buying new ingredients for every recipe. It's not practical and it's a waste of money. So in my book, the ingredients are so common and it's got a fabulous index. So like you'll see if there's one ingredient, at least there are some 5-10 recipes. And you can easily, you know, if you bought that ingredient once, I want them to use it a few times and not just buy one ingredient for one recipe. Yeah. I'm talking about like the dry provisions, not the fresh, of course.
Like hing, for example, if it's a non-hing using family.
So that's one reason why it's there. And, you know, let's see, after all, it's also a kind of a validation for a blogger that a publisher would like to publish your book. Because publishers don't just, unless they see that that potential and that that book will sell, they and that you're good and you're consistent, they're not going to give you a contract in the first place.
True.
So having a publisher approach you on their own and saying, hey, will you like to write with us, is a matter of great honor. And
I think so.
You know, I'm very grateful for that opportunity. So it was like, you know, that it was happened in 2015, I think. And I told myself that, you know, these 6 months, I'll devote myself to drawing out the proposal and sending it out to the publishers I can reach out to. And within a month, before I could even do anything, I had a mail from the other side. So I'm a big believer in things just happening, you know, when it's right for you.
Yes.
Yeah. So, you know, all that put together, the book just came together. And it, of course, it's something I wanted deeply. And it happened that I got approached and I didn't have to really ask too many people about, you know, sending proposals and waiting on it. And I'm grateful to Hachette for actually this thing happening. And I think it's also that the audience has seen a lot of value from us. Like for 15 years, we've given free content, free recipes, you know, answering their queries for free in the comments. So they're happy to buy a book and, you know, support your thing. It's not like...
I think they feel, you feel connected also. Like you feel connected with Nandita, Rushina, Sai, when you know, when you get the book. Tell me a bit about the new book coming out. What can we expect there?
The new book is called Everyday Superfoods. And no, it was not inspired by the pandemic. In fact, I had submitted my manuscript well before the lockdown happened.
Is the kanji there by any chance?
The kanji, beetroot is there, I think.
Beetroot is there. Okay, chalo.
Carrots are there. So the Everyday Superfoods is not like a 100% cookbook like this book. It's more like a paperback. It's got 75% is information, knowledge on... you know, how our present day lifestyle is. And, you know, the basic premise is just by eating a turmeric or an amla, which is definitely a superfood, I'm not going to change my life overnight.
Yes, exactly. Yes.
So there are a lot of baby steps, starting from actually introspecting on what we are eating currently, how we are eating. You know, we need to think of, we're in the fast lane. We just live life. We don't think about what we are doing. So just that mindfulness and drawing your attention back to your habits to know what we are doing. So exploring our, examining our present day relationship with food. Then next step is how to make it better. Then the next step is how to add, how to make your diet a little bit better. Then add your superfoods to your diet and how to have it every day in different creative ways. By I've given a list of 39 superfoods, which I've selected that is easily available. It's local, it's desi, you know, and there are multiple ways to use them. So on that basis, I've selected those 39 superfoods. And each one has a little bit of history, a little bit of how to eat this, and scientifically proven health benefits, you know, where actual research has proven that this thing prevents diabetes or this one helps in blood sugar management and things like that. And like this, after going through all the 39 ingredients, I talk about sustainability, which is also very important. I can't just pump my body with superfoods while letting the planet go to hell. So we need to be more mindful about, you know, we want to eat healthy, we want to be healthy, but we should also take care of the environment, you know, and the planet at large. So being mindful, I mean, things like if everybody starts growing turmeric, because turmeric is the next big thing, it's going to be very bad for the land, for the farm, for the farmers, etc. We need to, you know, which is why we need to look at what is seasonal, what is local, you know, how to, these little things which are quite complicated, but I've tried to put my head around it in my own way. I'm not saying I have all the answers, but at least put a thought into the reader's head, you know, to think about, okay, I'm eating quinoa, fine. You know, where has it come from? Has it been grown in India? A lot of quinoa is grown in India currently.
Yes.
So is it better than rice? Because rice uses way too much water to grow and quinoa uses less water to grow. So these kind of things, you know, in a way, so that's the whole chapter about sustainability. And then I've given 60 recipes, out of which nearly one fourth is all about meal prep. Because, you know, eating healthy, people ask me, how is it sustainable to cook every day and to make sure you're cooking healthy? So for that, you know, if you expect that all three meals have to be cooked fresh and put in front of you, it's not sustainable unless that's your full-time job. You can't do that yourself. So in that way, how to prep, how to keep certain things in your fridge, like you shell a pomegranate, you cook your chickpeas. If you're cooking brown rice, cook extra because it takes a long time to cook. Yes. So why will you cook only this much portion?
Yes. Yes.
Make extra. When you're cooking beans, make extra. So when you want to make a salad, everything, you open your fridge, five ingredients are there, just put it in, you have a good salad. So, you know, little things like that. So the initial 15 recipes are all about meal prep. So even if you stock up on 3-4 of those, you are really sorted in terms of adding these superfoods, because that's how you can eat them every day. If I say eat some complicated, you know, thing made out of something, how am I going to make it every day and eat? Even though I spend so much time in the kitchen, even I don't have the bandwidth to do that. So expecting people who have a full-time job to actually take care of their health by spending so much time in the kitchen, it's not feasible. So it's just getting very practical, and you know, and then there are these other recipes for beverages and some vegetables and different categories. Again, my recipes are all like, I also give variations, if not this, use this, so you get a like whole new recipe at the end of it. So that's how the flow of the book is. So I'm quite happy that it's not like an out and out cookbook. I have actually put in a lot of thought to tell people what I think about. And I also understand the superfood buzzword is like so done to death. Every thing you see, go to a supermarket, if you do go these days, you'll find like this superfood, that superfood. And, you know, even water purifiers say the water coming out of our purifier is a superfood. Like, I'm really done with this. But I'm tried my best to select things which are actually more nutrition per gram of food is what is a superfood. Like, it's very nutrient dense per calorie, you know. So if I'm it's not like I'm consuming 1,000 calories and I'm getting a tiny bit of nutrients. I'm consuming 100 calories, but it's full of nutrients. So it's just that such nutrient dense food, and including that is just having multiple health benefits. And why not, you know, eat that? If it's easy to eat it every day, why not eat that every day and, you know, help your body be in the best possible shape, be it. So there's also a chapter on specific superfoods, which is, I talk about the foods for diabetes, for good skin and hair, for people who are anti-cancer superfoods, for children, what are the good superfoods to include? Because everyone's requirements are different, and accordingly, the kind of foods to eat, you know, I'm not saying it's going to cure cancer, cure diabetes, or like make your child like a super he-man or like a she-woman. Nothing super about it. But the best effort that we can do, instead of eating this, why not eat that, you know, if it can do better for you. So that's the whole gist of the book. It's out on March 1st. And it's out on pre-order right now. And it's also, I'm very happy to note that it's on a few bestseller lists already, even though it's just on pre-order. And I promise you, it's not timed for the pandemic or anything. It just got delayed and it's out now. It's also an all-time book. I'm not saying that this is only to improve your immunity during COVID and nothing. I don't want to make it sound so frivolous. It's something that we need to have in our diet all the time. So if you're eating three meals, why not eat well, you know? So that's my whole premise.
Well, you put in a lot of riders into it, Nandita, but I don't think you should. I must say that my appetite has been completely whetted. As a person, I've changed over the years from the time when I first knew you versus now. And over the last two, 3 years...
You all know that, thanks to your very transparent posts on social media.
Well, I've been eating a lot of the sort of food which you believe in from a philosophy point of view, and I think that what the pandemic did is that it was a hard stop. In fact, what Chef Manisha Bhasin of the ITC Hotels said it made us reboot ourselves. And well, if it's made us more conscious of what we eat, then why not? But I was really excited by what you said, because it sounds so practical, especially when you said about the thing about the brown rice. Like, I consume a lot of red rice and black rice nowadays, but I know that it's not something I can have on a whim. So, you know, I have to cook it in advance or keep it in the fridge for the next day and stuff like that. But it sounds like a very exciting book, because it's from